This is Professor Allen, and welcome to the Quarter Bin. Every episode of this podcast, I will summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a single issue from my comic book collection, which I will select sort of at random. Any book from my comic book collection is eligible, as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for it. Was the issue worth 25 cents? Was it a bargain at 25 cents? Or was it still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. For this 138th episode of the Quarter Bin, we are, for the first time in Quarter Bin history, heading to a galaxy far, far away. By looking at Star Wars, Tales from Mos Eisley. It's a one-shot from Dark Horse Comics, cover dated March 1996. This is our first time tackling a Dark Horse title, although technically speaking, it's a reprint book put out by Dark Horse, containing stories originally appearing in Star Wars Galaxy magazine published by Topps Comics. And we have covered a Topps book before, X-Files Zero in episode 67 from about 3.5 years ago. But that's all stuff that we'll get to later. First, a little feedback. On episode 136, Queen and Country, we got this from YouTuber Lizanne Oswald. Check out her channel. Queen and Country sounds like it was a good enough book. Not sure how real it is. Maybe close enough for a good story. Tara seems like a good lead, competent without being a Mary Sue. As for reading novels and comics with the same character, the one I can think of is Harry Dresden. I like Jim Butcher, as he was one of us before making it big, so he has no problem writing comics about Dresden or the novels. Granted, Guns N' Roses took less time to put out Chinese Democracy than it's taking Jim to finish his latest book. Still, that and a few adaptations of Anne Rice's Vampire Tales are about the only crossover books to comics that I've read. But again, this did sound like a good enough spy thriller. Can't wait to hear the next Quarter Bin podcast. Looks like you found a good one this time. Thank you, Lizanne. Always good to hear from you. One additional thing on that concept of the crossovers from novels and comics, and this is something I've talked about on the most recent Comics Reading Journal, and that is that I've been enjoying the comic series Rivers of London, written by Ben Aronovich, in which his character Peter Grant works as a police investigator, and he's also a practicing wizard. Anyway, while doing a little bit of research on this series, and I know Nathaniel Wayne, I should let this be a lesson to myself on the dangers of research. What I stumbled across was that Aronovich actually produced 3 novels about Grant before moving the stories into comics. So, because I have problems, I'm going to stop reading the comics until I can get caught up with those novels, which do take place earlier in Grant's career before the comics start up. I know. On Time Warp from last episode, Lizanne also had a few things to say about that while making the appropriate Rocky Horror joke in the title of her email. Hi, Professor Allen. Impressive podcast and interesting stories. I've always heard that sci-fi started with Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, the new Prometheus. That would also fit the horror vein of some of the stories in this comic. That's an interesting point. There was one story in there that kind of has a similar plot to an old EC comic. The one where the guy's brother becomes a monster. But in the EC comics, it's a starship crew looking for another crew, and they see weird aliens and shoot them. And after they wreck on the planet, they slowly turn into the monsters that they saw before. At any rate, I do like that original better. So overall, I can see why this title didn't do well. It needed a hero story or something. Space horror is not really going to bring in Star Wars fans. Anyway, can't wait to hear the next podcast. And before I go, did I mention I have a YouTube page? That's Lizanne Oswald. Thank you, LA. Always good to hear from you. And in about 20 or 25 minutes, that comment about Star Wars and horror comics is going to be interesting. The Doc Strange Twitter feed said the cover was great. Subscribed! Isn't there some Ditko in there? And of course, there was two stories worth. Sir Martin of Grey commented on that awesome Time Warp logo, saying it remains one of the most impressive I've ever seen, a typically remarkable job by Todd Klein. Serge Bamba said this was the first anthology book he ever read. How that preceded Marvel Comics Presents is beyond me, but it happened. On the subject of anthology books, Jeff's Comics wondered why sci-fi anthologies were not more popular in American comics. They did well on radio, and like radio, comic books are excellent for budget-conscious special effects. I pointed out that that is true as our prose short stories, an area that sci-fi thrived in from the 40s onward. Jeff replied that, I guess, publishers tried but ended up selling what the American public wanted, superheroes, which at the time were mostly confined to the pages of comic books. But the ability of comics as a media to shine with science fiction is enormous. I agree with that, and I would love to see it tried again. We heard from our old good buddy, Dr. Ange. Great review, Professor Allen. I also grew up in the time of dollar comics, and remember how this title was touted back in the day. So much, I bought it then at the princely sum at the time. Ah yes, the days when a dollar cover price was outrageous. I miss those days. Somewhere along the way, the book got lost in a parental purge. But I found it recently, ironically enough, in a dollar box, and bought it. I like the Snowstorm one and the Spider one. Perhaps my love of Steve Ditko showing a bit too much with those choices. But the grotesque purple fruit monster one was what I found most horrifying. Do you starve to death or mutate? I shiver at the thought. And on the topic of short stories in general, Ange shared this. My town has a short story contest every year. The maximum is 1,000 words, so perfect comic anthology length, usually no more than 2 or 3 pages of written text. I submit every year, and each time my stories have a twist. I assume that is how it's supposed to be done. I'd like to hear what others have to say. Well, fortunately, Mr. Panarese and Miss Bowman of Required Reading had this to say. Okay, it's summer vacation, and they're probably way too busy lounging by the pool in order to listen to the episode, much less give feedback. But I'm sure if they did, when they eventually do, it'll confirm what Ange just said. We heard again from Trevor Owen Williams, who said he loved the series as a kid, but I haven't revisited it. Hopefully it still stands up, but worth the discount bins for the covers alone, I'd say. Covers were pretty good for all 5 issues of the series. Agreed, Trevor. The covers were all strong, to varying degrees. I should have mentioned this in that episode, especially about how excited the editors were to get off the ground, you know, telling that story about sci-fi, selling again, and all of that. But Time Warp only lasted 5 bi-monthly issues. And although the DC implosion was behind us at this point, maybe they just weren't ready for another expansion of their line just yet. Ben Avery from Supersonic Pod Comics and the Comic Book Time Machine said he was looking forward to listening. I really loved this comic. The Lev Gleason Twitter page called it another great episode. Very kind, thank you. And we heard from Carla, who wasn't writing in specifically about any Quarterbin episode, but she did touch on the topic of cheap comics, so I felt this was the most appropriate show for going over at least that part of her email. Hi again, Professor Allen. Have you checked out Hamilton Booksellers? You can shop online or via the catalog by mail. Shipping is always $4. The prices are pretty good, and in the last few years, they've started to sell trades and manga, and some multi-packs of single comics. Trades can be slightly higher than, say, Ollie's, but there's a lot of good deals. Back in December, I bought a 10-pack of Constantine for $4.95, to which I say, of course you did, Carla. And then a month later, the price went down to $2.95 until they sold out. $2.95 for 10 comics is darn close to a quarter. So close, in fact, I might even count it. And Carla continues to confirm that I do read other things besides Constantine. DC Bombshells trades are back in stock for $5.99 and $6.99, way less than when I paid for them when I went on a recent vacation. Happy Friday, Carla. And a happy Friday to you, too. Of course, I always want to hear any and all sources for comic book bargains that anyone finds out there. Podcasting's Michael Bailey wanted me to cover another issue of that title so we could all do the time warp again. Clinton from Coffee and Comics on the same track asked if the book was just a jump to the left. Paul Hicks said it was interesting and something he'd never heard of. Well, 5 issues, 40 years ago. I can see that, Paul. And a shout-out goes to Kevin Wetter, who saw this post after it was shared by Shag.
The irredeemable Shag.
And he reported that at HeroesCon, he picked up all 5 of these. He didn't mention a price, so I imagine he may have paid more than a quarter each, but still, great finds. And on the topic that I touched on, the idea of words that have changed meanings over the years, we got a note from a listener who wished to remain anonymous, who acknowledged that they were coming from a position of privilege in commenting. I understand the magnitude of the World War II atrocity and agree with a judicious use of the word Holocaust. Do you think capitalizing Holocaust differentiates it enough from the generic word? Now, to me, that seemed too subtle a differentiation to be, you know, truly safe from criticism, for at least from being misunderstood. In written work, it might be a legitimate thing, but of course, in spoken communication, that capital letter versus lowercase, that distinction is just literally not going to be heard. Our listener continued that if words are considered forbidden as a rule follower, I want them across the board forbidden, regardless of background or intent. That would just make my life easier. But as you say, those among the offended groups have the right to teach what is okay and what isn't. Thank you for writing in. That was a touchy subject, and I want to thank M for serving as my woke consultant, as I put it, and they helped me shape that and keep it on this side of the appropriateness line, or at least they tried. Social media love for last episode came from, and it's a long list, and we appreciate each and every person mentioned. Luke Giaconetti, Kirk Spencer, Big Five Army, Michael Scudurlo, Scott Rowland, Clinton from Coffee and Comics, Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us, the irredeemable Shag, Joe Cabrera, A Bug and a Flea, Manuel Carmona from Truthful Comics, Movie Mad Matt, Ned Head, King Dinosaur, Drew from Comics for Fun and Profit, and also from the office just down the hallway and around the corner from me, Lord Metallic, Mike Peacock from Justice's First Dawn, stand-up comic Rob Deb, Paul from the Collected Edition podcast, Slang Word Scott, reigning Listener of the Year Nathaniel Wayne from the Council of Geeks, Sir Iowa's Joe, the Duchess and Duke of the Sutherlands from Trekker Talk and many other fine podcasts, Pat from the Long Box Crusade, Old School Ross, and Laurel, a.k.a. Mountain Flower One from the Huntress podcast. Thank you for all that love and support. Much appreciated. Let's take a quick break here, and when we come back, me and a guest will talk about Star Wars Tales of Mos Eisley.
Welcome to the world of tomorrow!
The Legion of Superheroes through the Silver Age, the Bronze Age, the Baxter series, 5 years later, the reboot, the three-boot, the retro-boot, the animated series. We have banded together as the Legion of Super Bloggers to cover it all. Seek us out at legionofsuperbloggers.blogspot.com.
Always have to say it that way.
Haven't you ever heard of a little thing called showmanship?
And we're back. And by we,
I don't just mean myself and my rolls and rolls of quarters. For I'm joined by a podcasting contemporary, a man who embodies the notion of don't mess with Texas, and who recently added the additional title of newlywed. Welcome back to the Quarterbin, special guest Trennis Magnus.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. And you know what? I actually checked the calendar. It's actually been quite a while since I was last on your show, so it's always a pleasure to be here.
It is always good to speak with you. Now, I remember back when your podcasting network, empire, first began to stride the world like a colossus. And in those early days, Star Wars was part of the formula. So it's safe to say that you have a strong appreciation or fandom for the franchise?
Yes, I do. I'm coming at this from kind of it's strange to think, you know, you're getting so close to 40 and you still kind of consider yourself to be part of the younger generation. The semi-young-ish, kind of in a way, maybe, generation. We're coming at Star Wars fandom, I think, from a much different point of view, I think, from, I guess, the first wave of Star Wars fans, at least for me. These were films that I grew up with. This may strike some as kind of an annoying comparison, but for me, there was materially no difference between my affection for Back to the Future or The Goonies and the Star Wars trilogy. I mean, they were all just about on the same level to me. Even though, let's face it, there are people out there who are maybe Goonies enthusiasts, but are they truly Goonies fans? Are there any Goonies fans? I mean,
or is there a fandom for it?
Exactly that, yeah. And so these were movies that I just grew up with. I mean, everybody loves Chewie, everybody loves Vader, you know, and it was just kind of part of the cultural landscape for people my age in a way that it really wasn't for the first wave of fans who were like, this was the end all be all. I even talked about it in an episode that I recorded yesterday, that this is the primary mythological construct for that first wave of fans. And it really wasn't for me when I was a kid. These were movies that I enjoyed. I had the action figures and it was great, but it lacked that personal investment, at least for me. And that, again, a little bit of a controversial opinion here, perhaps, but here it is anyway. That didn't really change until episode one came out. And all at once, it was like, okay, my God, this backstory of of the original trilogy, this is, I guess, like the foundation for it. And I'm not here to defend or excuse or justify every single part of The Phantom Menace. There are parts of it that I think are brilliant. And there are other parts of it where it's like, George, what were you thinking? You know, but it's like, for me, the good definitely outweighed the bad with that film. And it kind of gave me an access point, not into Star Wars, but in perhaps more specifically into Star Wars fandom. And so that began a process of, I would say, devouring as much Star Wars material as I could get my hands on, different novels. I never, you know what? It's kind of ironic that you brought me in for specifically this episode, because I was never really big on Star Wars comics. It was always really difficult for me to do that. But, you know, reading all of these products that we call the expanded universe, especially the Bantam era of the expanded universe, the Del Rey period and all that new Jedi Order stuff, not bad. Not necessarily always great, but definitely not bad. But some of that stuff that was coming out all through the 90s, wow, that is the courtship of Princess Leia. If there's any such thing as a stoner literati, this has got to be like your personal cornucopia. I mean, it's like one page of another after another of, whoa, wait, what did I just read? Like, whoa, what is this? You know?
Yeah, I think that is universally considered the low point.
It ended up sort of cooling off a little bit, at least for me. There came a point when The Phantom Menace was re-released in theaters. And so I actually saw The Phantom Menace again in theaters. And one of the things that I sort of took from that experience was, wow, you know, I guess before what I was kind of getting into was the John Williams score. I was getting into how awesome Obi-Wan Kenobi is, or I was enjoying the visual effects and Coruscant and these really sophisticated literary themes that George Lucas was exploring and the creative risks and chances that he took with certain elements and subplots of the prequels. But sitting there in the theater, it was like 2012 or something like that, when The Phantom Menace was re-released, it's like, for the first time, I could see where the naysayers were coming from. I hadn't seen the movie in probably like 5 or 6 years up to that point. And rewatching it again then, I started to think, you know what? Maybe the naysayers, I'm not going to say they were right about everything, but they had a point. And so that was, I guess, the beginning of sort of backing away a little bit from Star Wars and just really loving the original Unaltered trilogy. You know, the amazing things, effects-wise and whatever else that were achieved in those films. And not necessarily distancing myself from the prequels, but maybe being a little bit more objective about the prequels. And in the end, what I decided was I've got the movies that I think are important, which is Star Wars 77, Empire, and Jedi. And whatever investments that people have in Star Wars vis-a-vis fandom, whether it's the prequels or Clone Wars or these new movies that are coming out, Rogue One or Solo or just whatever, you know, if other people want to get into other facets of Star Wars, that's for them to do. But I don't think that's especially for me. And so that's kind of where I'm coming from these days as a Star Wars fan. And I hope I didn't talk your ear off.
You know, with talking about that, those first batch of novels. I mean, I read the first couple of dozen of those.
Yeah.
And that was the time when it was possible to keep up with them.
Yeah.
The sort of the inside cover would have a list, maybe a little timeline.
Oh, I remember those, yeah.
35 books or something that, in other words, before the output exploded and it became impossible. So yeah. I ended up quitting those before I realized I'd never become Scott Rifen and have them all. So I was just overwhelmed at that point and just gave up.
I will say this. The New Jedi Order errs on the side of being a little bit more hard sci-fi than I think Star Wars really should be. But I will say that in general, I do at least recommend the hard covers of the New Jedi Order. Now, if you want to read the paperbacks that fill in all the blanks in between, be my guest. But at the very least, the hard covers, and I would say especially Star by Star by Troy Denning, that is a real sucker punch. Now, I don't necessarily want to get going on a tangent on that too much, but I will say that if you read the book, and just keep in mind that this came out in October of 2001, there are certain things that happen in that book that are very resonant to American readers in October of 2001. I cried. And I can only think of one other time I've read a book and actually had tears in my eyes, but that time I did. And so I think that the hardcovers of that series for sure are definitely worth reading. Again, maybe you'll like it, maybe you won't, but I think anybody would see the merit to it. Mm-hmm. So anyways.
Now, one of the books I did read was a paperback collection of short stories from 1995 called Tales from the Mos Eisley Cantina. I think there was a Tales from Jabba's Palace and one other.
Well, those are the Bounty Hunters.
Okay, that's right. That's the other one I was thinking of, yeah. And those, you know, the Mos Eisley one, you know, comprised of just a bunch of short stories featuring the background characters found in the cantina. Members of the band and Greedo and basically every individual alien who was on screen for, you know, one cell. One frame got a short story written about them. And I'm not sure if this, I could quite discover if this, the title of these stories, Tales from Mos Eisley, was just sort of coincidental or whether they were intended to tie in. I mean, they're not related to the stories in the paperback collection, but, you know, something about that name hitting just at about the right time. This is a one-shot. The three stories appeared around 1995. In Topps Star Wars Galaxy magazine.
Right.
Three 8-page stories in there collected into this. And this version of it, Tales from Mos Eisley, at a cover price of $2.95, meaning I acquired the comic at a very satisfying 91.5% discount, and I'm not going to ask how much you paid, because I know it was more, and I apologize.
Well, we'll circle back to that soon enough. We'll circle back. It's all right. Keep going. This is good.
Well, let's look at this cover. I'm looking at a cover by Dean Williams with a mean werewolf-looking dude holding up a smoking gun against a deep orange sky.
Yes, indeed.
First impressions of that, Trennis?
When you sent me the message and you were sort of kicking the idea around, hey, I'm thinking about talking about this comic. Would you want in on this if I decide to go for it? I'm going to be honest with you. I was real iffy about it, you know? Because, again, not big on Star Wars comics, right? So went ahead and popped open Comixology, and I looked at the cover. And I took one look at this, and I thought, okay, so it's Mr. Blueface Wolf Guy from the Cantina, and it's obviously to do in some way or another with Mos Eisley. Holy crap, yes, I want in on this so bad. So, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that this is the greatest comic book cover in the history of anything ever, because I don't think it is, but it is a good piece of art, and it, I think, kind of sells more, I guess, like the mood and atmosphere of what they're trying to go for in these stories. But if you're looking for a story where Mr. Blueface Wolf Guy holds up a smoking blaster set against the sandy, dusky Tatooine sky, you're out of luck. But this, like I say, this is more of like a flavor sort of a cover than literal fact. So on that basis, I enjoy it.
Yeah, I mean, the most important part of the title, to be honest, are the two words Star Wars.
Yeah.
And then the two words Mos Eisley.
Yeah.
I mean, those are the key features in terms of selling this. That's the part that matters. But I do like the color scheme, and the guy looks sufficiently scummy and villainous.
Yes, he does.
That's all you're looking for. We are going to briefly talk about each of these three stories, and I will give credit to both the Wikipedia and Star Wars Comics Collectors blog as being helpful in providing the jumping-off points for preparing these plot summaries. Oh, I should mention all of these stories are written by Bruce Jones, and all of the art is Brett Blevins. So we start with Light Duty, which appeared in issue 4 of Star Wars Galaxy. So it was the last of the stories to appear originally, and the first in this reprint issue.
As it should be.
There you go. So we have, in Mos Eisley, Garv approaches Flick, a corporal in the Rebellion. And he's the werewolf-looking guy from the cover.
Right.
And Flick is complaining that he needs a reserve force of at least 20 fighters. And then Garv opens up a bag and spills a whole bunch of coins on the table and offers to buy Flick a drink. And then he tells his story. He received the pay for 2 weeks of work for the Empire at a location called Jellyfish Cove on a nondescript planetoid in the middle of nowhere. So he was hired by the Emperor to man an oceanside lighthouse, and he's told to stay inside at night and on foggy days. Spoilers, he's not going to. He explores the nearby area and finds a ruin with statues of beautiful women. That night, woken up by a tapping at the lighthouse's window, he sees a beautiful woman outside, but he can't get to her because he's locked in. The next day, he goes to the ruins and sees an alien in an orange jumpsuit, and then a group of that species assembles a raft on a beach, and they disperse as the fog rolls in. Garv returns to the lighthouse and is visited that night by two beautiful women tapping at the glass. I sense a trend there. Then a spacecraft lands on the beach, and more orange-suited aliens leave the craft. As the women near the aliens, they turn into jelly-like creatures and kill them. He realizes he is manning the beacon for a penal colony in Jellyfish Cove. It's named because these lady-being statues can turn into jellyfish-like creatures. The jumpsuit aliens are the prisoners, and he's the beacon guiding the ships in at night. So the next day, he visits the ruins, fog rolls in, statues come alive. Safe back at the lighthouse, a person approaches who looks like an Imperial soldier, although a pretty darned attractive one, But right. Once inside, she turns into one of the creatures and attacks.
And I'm going to have to butt in here and say, just you have no idea what I would have given for this guy to say, aren't you a little hot for a stormtrooper?
Perfect. That would have been perfect. And then back at Mos Eisley, Garv explains that he was able to kill the creature. And when the next prison vessel arrived, he killed the guards, took their money, blew up the beacon, and used the prison ship to escape. Although I have to admit, those last 2.5 panels of text would have made a another pretty good 8-page story.
Yes, it would.
Don't you hate it when they describe stuff that sounds that exciting and cool?
Yeah, I mean, they spend so much time in this thing describing or showing like the mood and the atmosphere of things, and it's like, yeah, but you know, they've got 8 pages to work with. There's only so much you can do. But yeah, I guess that's the end of the story, isn't it?
Yeah, he points to another group of the aliens outside that he's rescued, the prisoners, and says that these are the new reserve force for the rebel. The end. So, as my friend Trennis Magnus would ask, hey, Trennis Magnus, what'd you think of this?
Honestly, this story was hands down my favorite in the entire issue. And I'm going to be real honest with you about this. I wasn't really sure how things were going to turn out. Don't get me wrong. I like Brett Blevins. All right. I'm a Brett Blevins fan from way back. And I tend to think that, you know, all through his career, especially in the 90s, I don't know that he ever really got the due that he deserved, at least in my mind. I knew him best from, you know, various and sundry of his Batman work. And you want to talk about some good stories. Those are some really good ones. But how well is that kind of, I don't know, not quite horror, but not quite Archie either. He has just this kind of bizarre style. And I'll be the first to admit, it's a little bit of an acquired taste. And I wasn't at all certain how well this is going to work with something even tangentially associated with Star Wars. Mm-hmm. And yet here, what you see is that with each passing page, he's figuring out how best to manipulate his line style to match the material. And I respect that, you know, because so often in comics, what you see is an artist will sometimes try to manipulate the material to suit his style.
Okay.
And that doesn't necessarily always work. And it's kind of nice to see that Blevins didn't even attempt that here. He tried as best as he could to conform his style to Star Wars generally, but specifically to the story that's being told here. And I think the end result is this kind of light sort of horror vibe. It's not really full macabre or anything like that, but it's got a little bit of scary movie elements going to it.
But
goes too far.
Yeah, the abandoned lighthouse.
Yeah.
Just that motif.
Yeah.
Is such a, like you said, maybe light horror.
Yeah.
You know, you're out in the middle of nowhere, you're alone, it's scary, it's creepy, it's weird. You know, it fits that criteria. Again, I don't know if we ever saw any other Oceanside lighthouses in Star Wars.
None that I know of.
You know, that's some of the issue I have with some of these stories is, okay, this is actually a really good story. Oh, it's a Star Wars story so much, but at that point, you know, sort of what difference does it make at that point? And most of the little bit of research I did trying to find some information about this book, basically every review or comment said, well, it starts with the best story.
Really? Okay.
And so that you are certainly not alone, and I am in agreeance with you on that as well.
One of the other notes I had is that I kind of like the idea of using, these are basically sirens.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And when you think about it, you know, for the amount of dependence that Star Wars is alleged to have on myth and whatnot, to throw in sirens, I mean, how obvious was
logic
that?
There, right.
Yeah.
That's true. So. One thing I liked is there were a lot of words in this story.
Yeah.
It's like they had an 11-page script and 8 pages to squeeze it into, and that's not that bad. I mean, it actually took a little while to read, more than an 8-page story can do.
And it, I mean, overall, you know, they say it's supposed to be one of the highest compliments that a reader or viewer or whatever that the audience can give when they say they want more. I think it's actually, it says quite a lot that you and I want more of this, you know, that why couldn't it have been longer or just whatever. The ending, as you say, is a little pat, but as a certain professor friend of mine is wont to say, endings are hard. And I can only imagine they're doubly hard with 8 pages to work with. So in the main, I've got no complaints whatsoever. This is a fun little story.
Yep. You won't know this because the episode hasn't been released yet, but the episode before this will be the first issue of the late 1970s DC sci-fi anthology Time Warp. And a story like this, you know, you change a few words, you change a few references, and this could fit right into there, or even into a House of Mystery or something like that. You know, it fits into that, again, that sort of light horror or light sci-fi, you know, any type of anthology. And I don't have a problem saying that. Cool vibe, pretty good story.
Very enjoyable. And right here, this is the last page of the story. I was banging away about Brett Blevins just a little while ago, but here, to me, this is where this last page of the story, it really hits home that he truly has manipulated his style quite heavily. The woman, the siren, whatever you want to call her, she does not look like a conventional Brett Blevins illustrated woman. She actually has this just very clean look about her. She's very attractive. And I'm not saying that, you know, Brett Blevins had a thing for drawing, you know, these scary, withered-looking old hags and stuff. But just looking at this out of context, the first assumption I would make is not that this was drawn by Brett Blevins. So anyone who's listening to this and you've kind of got an idea of what his style is, just try to put that to the side. He really does deliver the goods on this in a big way.
Next up, the second story is Mostly Automatic, originally appearing in issue 3 of the magazine. So as we work forward in the book, we're working backwards through the way these appeared originally. We have an alien pilot, Besom. He sits down with like a 90-something-year-old man, Tem Chesko. Chesko points outside the cantina's window at his ship, tells Besom that he just landed here this morning after a 71-year Syntonium Crystal Hall. And Besom asks for that story. So a 22-year-old Chesko speaks with the mine operator, tells him that the ship is loaded for his trip home. Chesko expects to have a boring 2-week flight until an asteroid hits him, stranding him. Now he figures he has a 60-year journey facing him. And after 8 years of growing progressively more insane, he finally notices a break glass in case of emergency pane and releases a feminine green service droid that he names Millie. Millie saves him from a plant-like monster on one planet, and they grow close. Years and years later, however, Chesko makes the mistake of reminiscing about his old girlfriend, Maya. This causes the droid to attempt to short-circuit herself out of jealousy. Dames, am I right?
I'm not going anywhere near that one, ma'am. That's all you.
So he talks her out of suicide, and as he grows old and weak, she continues to care for him. And at age 86, he asks his droid to kill him, handing the robot AI his laser knife. And then back in Mos Eisley, the old man tells Besom that that was the hardest day of his life. Besom asks how he could still be here and what happened to Millie. And he answers both questions. It's opening up a chest plate and revealing Millie's inner workings, which have been transplanted into him. She's right here, right in my heart. The end. Okay, I had no idea where this one was going.
Yeah.
I can't speak for you, but I was surprised up to that last panel.
Well, I mean, I figured if you're going to do a bunch of 8-page short stories, you kind of have to end each of them with their own special little twist.
Right.
And we got one in the last story, obviously, where what's his name basically escapes from the prison planet with the prisoners in tow. And here are the new rebellion forces that you need. And so This is actually kind of dark. I mean, this is
man, I'm not sure what to make of that.
I'm kind of a fan of EC Comics, and so I'm used to seeing, twists and stuff like that near the end. Yeah, and that's kind of what this reminded me of. And in a weird kind of way, you could argue that this is not really a happy ending at all. I mean, number one, he is in a certain kind of sense in love with Millie. And number two, she may have effectively made him in some way or another immortal. That is not necessarily a blessing to give to somebody who's in his psychological state.
Yeah.
And so she could be condemning him to decades upon decades of loneliness and misery and insanity. And I mean, there is a way of reading the story where this is a very, in a weird kind of way, kind of happy, sort of uplifting story about mutual dependence and self-sacrifice and all that. Another way of looking at it is she's kind of damning him, you know? And anyway, so whatever you want to do with that.
But both of them seem to have their own psychological issues.
Yes.
I mean, the AI attempting to commit suicide out of jealousy, it's a little unexpected.
Yeah.
But I do like, you know, again, sort of back to fitting into the Star Wars world, the fact that this was so droid-centric, and we have seen so many different versions of droids with their own personalities, with their own quirks, with their own design features. You know, that one, this could happen in the Star Wars world.
Yes. On that note, actually, it makes you wonder, as you read this story, how many times maybe has this happened? Because on page 3, this is really the big setup for the story right here, where the ship gets nailed with an asteroid, and that takes the hyperdrive out of whack. And apparently this ship is not equipped with any kind of an SOS or anything like that. And so how many ships are there out there where people are just floating around helpless, trying to get from one star to the next, having to do so at sublight speeds?
Yeah.
When you start thinking about it from that point of view, the story, which was already, I think, kind of dark to begin with, it takes another dark turn. So
I like the idea that he knew he'd be stranded for decades and was not expecting to be discovered.
Right.
I like the idea that space is really, really big.
Yes.
And you are probably not going to be just stumbled upon. And that isn't specifically said, but that's part of the storytelling.
Right.
That if you're just drifting out here, no one's going to find you by accident. You're not going to get lucky.
Right.
I do question why it takes him 8 years to find the emergency, in case of emergency, break glass, which is like, you know, an 8-foot tall pane of glass.
Yeah, and how could he miss it? Right.
Yeah, or not know. Yeah. I mean, hey, he's growing progressively crazy, so maybe that's part of it. Or maybe I'm taking my Earth-based bias with me. But I assume here you have to be kind of smart to be a pilot.
Yeah.
You know, there's some education levels and so forth. But in the Star Wars world, maybe you can be a starship pilot and kind of a low IQ individual.
Just trying to find a way to kind of rationalize this to myself, what I kind of wondered, because I don't think it ever comes out, you know, how exactly he came about getting this ship. And so I wondered, was this his first time flying it? You know, it's a loaner from whoever the boss is, and, you know, maybe he's not familiar with it. I mean, I tried to think of some ways to kind of no-prize that. And, I mean, ultimately, you know, I don't think it's a deal-breaker in the story, but if you need some kind of a rationalization for it, well,
yeah.
I think there are ways of making that work. So,
yeah, that's true. Again, kind of a dark, horror-tinged sort of story.
Yeah.
I like that. And then we close up with Higgs' tale.
Yes.
And in this one, it's too wild inside the cantina. Too much fighting, too many laser blasters for spacer Sam Higgs. So he heads outside for someplace quiet to drink. He meets a bounty hunter drinking some honest-to-goodness Vashan rye. And he offers a grumpf egg in exchange for a sip. The bounty hunter, Jeet, asks to hear how he got the egg, to prove that it really is a grump egg. And so he tells his story. Higgs explains that he was out past the icy Nimba 5, tracking Bemis Hyde, when he stumbled down onto a full nest of Grumph eggs. He saw somehow a large jungle just down a small slope of deep, cold ice. He climbed down and soon saw a young man being chased by a large, purple, vicious Grumph, who runs right past Higgs and chases the young guy up a tree. Higgs' blaster bolts go right through the being, not hitting it or not hurting it at all. Right. There's a rip in the time fabric. He can see them, but they can't see him. But he has to do something to help the kid. He then runs back to the eggs and shoots at them, causing the Grumph, and then in fact all of the jungle, to fade away.
Yeah.
The young man thanks the stranger, whoever he is, as he fades back to his own time and place. Back outside Mos Eisley, Higgs explains to Jeet that the young man was himself, and that destroying the eggs in the present, for some ridiculous reason, that caused the Grumph in the past to never be born, so the kid, the younger self, doesn't get killed, and here he is today, old and grizzled. Jeet doesn't believe that crazy story, because it makes no sense at all, and he takes back his bottle, only to find that Higgs has already emptied it. The old man gives him the promised egg, and Jeet slurps down the pure nectar, but it's awful, tasting like battery acid. And the old guy laughs at him. That a fact. Never tried the stuff myself. The end. So, two horrors and humor.
Yeah.
But like you said, they do all end with sort of a punch.
Yeah.
And I do like that for the setup of all these stories, that kind of makes sense. Because it's not just that, I mean, we're not reading the stories as they happened. We're overhearing the stories being told at the cantina.
Right.
And when you're telling a story, well, you're not going to tell a story that kind of ends bland and, or there's no resolution, or, right? When you're telling a story to your buddies or strangers or whatever, it's going to end funnier and scarier and horror, and it's going to end with a punch.
Yeah, yes, it will.
So there's some logic to that, I think, structurally within the stories.
Yeah, and honestly, I mean, of them all, this is the one that feels least Star Wars to me. You know, the idea of some young little whippersnapper shooting the bull with some old timer and they're trading tall tales with each other. That part obviously is pretty easy to buy into, especially in the Mos Eisley Cantina. But the part about this that just kind of lost me a bit is this whole pseudo time travel type of thing where
I don't remember any of that in any Star Wars thing.
Yeah, that's a little too hard sci-fi for my taste. Now, if this were to be a Star Trek comic book, well, now we're in business. But this, look, I mean, it's like, on the one hand, it's not really worth making a big deal out of, but nevertheless, this is a little bit of a stylistic departure. Now, what I took from this, like, the reason that this worked is, maybe I'm misinterpreting the story, but when Elder Higgs is blasting away at the eggs, he's the last one, that's the one that does the trick. And that's actually the Grumph's egg himself. The tear in the space-time continuum basically has put Elder Grumph, Elder Beast, whatever we're calling him, in the same context, same timeline as younger Higgs. And so it's up to Elder Higgs to kind of save the day a bit. But it's only whenever you kind of bend spoons on this a little bit that you realize, or at least that I realized, why shooting the eggs, that's what saved the day. You know, it took me a while to kind of grasp that. Now, it could just be I read this thing when I was really tired, or it could be it's just not all that apparent in the story. I don't know. But that's what I took from it. But this whole idea of time travel, I'm just not really comfortable with that in Star Wars. But you know what? It's still kind of a fun story. And maybe what we can do is just look the other way on that, you know, and just enjoy this story for what it is and not nitpick about silly things, you know?
And I give them full credit for this on the last page, though, the guy who's being told the story says, wait a sec, you shot Grumph eggs in the present to save yourself in the past? That doesn't make any sense, does it? And the other guy says, beats me. So, I mean, at least there is literary term, hanging a lantern on it. They're not they're not pretending that it makes sense. They're saying, well, you know, he was desperate. He did something that worked. Really can't explain why. Now, that might not be the most satisfying solution in a serious story.
Yeah.
But I think ending it with a joke helps say, okay, this wasn't intended to be serious. Although, 7.5 pages of comic for one punchline, maybe that space could have been used better.
Yeah, I tend to agree. But, you know, I'm, you know, trying to look at this thing in a sort of holistic way, we've basically got three fun stories that don't take themselves too seriously. They don't ask the reader to take them all that seriously. And, you know, this is one of those things where the dramatic mandate for all of these stories is that they have to involve people telling each other stories in the Mos Eisley Cantina, because it's all in the name, you know, Tales from the Cantina. You know, so how well do each of these stories set about fulfilling their dramatic mandate? I would say really well. And
point, not to interrupt you, but I would also point out that each of these stories was intended to be 8 pages out of, I'm not sure what, 40, 50 pages, you know, of a magazine that wasn't just a comic book magazine.
Right.
My impression was that it, you know, covered Star Wars news and, you know, promotional stuff from movies and all that sort of stuff too. Interviews with various people, it sounded like. You know, so these weren't necessarily designed for hardcore comics readers. It was a comic story in the middle of a Star Wars magazine, not comic.
Right.
So that context, I think, let me be a little more charitable.
Exactly that. I don't know. I had a real ball reading all these stories, you know, and again, first one, clearly the best, but they all have their own peculiar charm. And I enjoyed myself, you know, reading these stories, you know, these sort of colorful characters that honestly, going into this thing, knowing nothing at all about these stories.
Yeah, me neither.
The fear, well, fear, that's maybe a too strong a word, but concern I had is, you know, if you're going to tell a story that's set in Mos Eisley, it's probably just a matter of time until Luke and or Han and or Chewie and or Ben Kenobi show up. And each of these stories handily avoids that. Mm-hmm. To me, the more creative thing to do is to break away from what we saw in the movies and show us something that the movies didn't.
Right.
And this story succeeds in that in a big way. Now, if I do have a criticism of this comic, and again, this is just, God, it's such a quibble. It's barely worth mentioning. But what I took from watching Star Wars 77 is that Mos Eisley is, this is like a really dangerous place to be. This is kind of like El Paso was back in the 1920s. Or I guess for that matter, what El Paso is today, you know, just this really dangerous place that you don't want to go into unless you have a good reason to be there and you don't stick around all that long. And you don't really get that sense of menace about it. But at the same time, this isn't about Mos Eisley. This is about the cantina and the wacky, colorful characters that come in through there. And so there is, I think, some creative and dramatic cover to not necessarily, you know, get into the kind of, you know, this is a dangerous old West type of town, you know, that maybe I was kind of expecting or sort of hoping for, sort of like the good, the bad, and the ugly set in outer space. This is not that, but that doesn't make it bad. But I do think, I maintain that there is a lot of disco potential in doing a kind of like an old West type of story set in Mos Eisley. And so I doubt anyone from Lucasfilm is listening to this. No offense, Professor, but if they are, hey, you've got my money. All right. You have me at hello. If you make that comic, I would love to buy that comic.
All right. I think you know what's coming.
We've
got three different stories, different tones, different situations, different types of stories. But overall, big picture, Trennis Magnus, your verdict on Star Wars Tales from Mos Eisley, was this comic book worth a quarter?
Well, I think I'm in a unique position to answer that question.
Because you paid a lot more for it.
I paid a lot more for it. Yeah, I paid a $1.99. So I do not regret my purchase. So if it's worth $1.99, it is absolutely worth a worth a quarter. I enjoy this, you know, especially like if you can get it for a quarter, get it for a quarter. So, Professor, what do you think? Is this worth a quarter for you?
It's just a little tricky because, again, I bought the comic because it had the Star and Wars right mm-hmm. there on the cover. And didn't necessarily get a ton of Star Wars. But, again, I can see how, as part of a Star Wars-themed magazine, you know, if you go a little light on the Star Wars specificity, you're getting those deep dives in the rest of the magazine, I'm sure. You'd be sort of more surrounded by more detailed Star Wars or specific Star Wars content, so that worked. But as we said, Bruce Jones, Brett Blevins especially, legitimate comic book professionals. And we get three solidly professional, enjoyable, sci-fi, slightly horror-tinged occasionally, comic book stories, and 25 cents is a pretty low bar and easy to clear. And so, yes, this was definitely a quarter bin deal.
All right. Well, I'm glad to hear it.
So that wraps up our coverage of Star Wars Tales from Mos Eisley, bringing episode 138 of the podcast to a close.
To a dramatic close.
Yes.
We have to end with a punch. So you have to say it's a dramatic close.
We've just been hanging here outside Mos Eisley Cantina, just shooting the breeze.
Mm-hmm. And drinking blue milk.
Well, Mr. Ternus Magnus, thank you so much for joining me on this one.
Thank you for having me. It's a blast. Yeah.
One last time, tell our listeners where they can find your podcasts and what they'll find on those podcasts.
So you guys, if you're interested in checking out my show, you can find it at twotruefreaks.com. My name is Trentus Magnus, and the name of my show is the cleverly titled Trentus Magnus Punches Reality. And therein, I talk about comics, movies, and TV shows. But realistically, the majority of my subject matter has revolved around comics. And so what I've been doing is trying to balance out the ledger on that a bit and talk a little bit more about and just different movies and whatnot that I've been watching and have enjoyed. There's a pair of irregular features. One of them involves Two True Freaks co-host and co-founder, Chris Honeywell, as he and I talk about weird stuff. So you may want to take a look at those episodes because they kind of defy categorization here. And then to close out the you know, the comics, the movies, and now the TV show part of my self-assigned creative mandate here. I do another irregular feature called Magnus Talks About Smallville, where I go through it, you know, episode by episode, season by season, talking about why it is that I think Smallville is awesome. And so in a nutshell, or maybe two or three nutshells, that's what my show's all about. So if that sounds like your brand of vodka, swing on by and give it a listen. I'd love to have you.
Highly recommend it. So next time in episode 139, because it's a number 9 episode, we'll be continuing our number 9 series by looking at Marvel Superheroes Magazine, number 4. Oh.
Yeah, I remember Magazine, yeah. M-E-G-A, Magazine, yeah.
Magazine. That is, of course, from Marvel Comics, cover dated January 1995. If you have any questions or comments about this issue or the episode, Star Wars Comics, or the podcast in general, feel free to contact me. Until next episode, I'm Professor Allen, and he's...
Trentus Magnus.
And I'll see you in the quarter bin.
The Quarterbin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, where the podcasts Uncovering the Bronze Age and Short Box Showcase also make their home. Links to Facebook and Twitter are there as well. Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening.